Everyone, and welcome to Mind Shift, the podcast that is here to assist you on your journey of deconstruction and discovery. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I am excited to be bringing you a brand new episode today from Richard Jacobson. We're going to be hearing from him. He has written a book called Unchurching: Christianity Without Churchianity. And this, as I've been saying for the last couple of weeks, is a major shift in the topics that we've been covering the last few weeks. If you've been listening, you'll know that I brought you two interviews with David Madison, who is a pastor turned atheist. But this week, we're going to hear a completely different point of view. And it's kind of a major departure from what I've been doing, exploring deconstructing Christianity, as well as the church and some of the other things, inerrancy that Ray Guilford and I did last year. All right, now we got to ask the question, who in the world is Richard Jacobson and where is he coming from? Well, there's one way to look at it, and that is that Richard is a number one. You say, wait a minute, Clint, what in the world is a number one? What are you talking about, man? Well, I am, of course, referring to the article that I wrote on Theology Corner entitled, What Happens After People Leave the Church? And what my article does is this. I list a possible 8 people on the spectrum, or 8 groups of people who have left the church behind. And as I've been doing over the last few weeks, I'm going to put a link to this article on Theology Corner in the show notes. So as it relates to my article, I believe that Richard Jacobson is a number one on the spectrum. Now, we're not going to know for sure until after this interview is over. We're going to come back to that, and I'm going to read to you my description of some of these categories, and we're going to try to see where Richard falls on this spectrum, because it's not about necessarily pigeonholing people or shoving them in a box and saying, well, this is where you're at on this scale of people who have left the church behind. It's about this journey, as I say, of deconstruction and discovery, because what I've been finding out myself is that as you begin the very process of deconstruction, it is then that you begin to embark on a journey of discovery. And it is amazing where this journey takes you. It's not about being stuck in one place forever. And as we hear Richard talk about his book and the things that he is passionate about, we're going to come back, as I say, and talk about that after the interview. Now, you may or may not agree with what Richard is saying. He very much identifies as a Christian, as someone who's very passionate about the church, and that's where he's coming from. And he's certainly aiming at a particular target audience. And so we're going to find out what he has to say in just a few minutes. And really, this speaks to the purpose of why I started this podcast, why I changed the name of it from the Preacher's Forum podcast to Mind Shift last year, because it's all about critical thinking about topics like God, the church, and spirituality. So we're going to apply critical thinking. How do you do that? How do you learn to think critically? Well, the best way you can do that is by being exposed to other points of view, things that you may or may not agree with, things that you may or may not have ever heard before, and trying to have a respectful dialogue, a respectful discussion, whether or not you're coming from exactly the same point of view. It really doesn't matter. It's all about learning to have a respectful discussion, a respectful dialogue, listening to other points of view, trying on other perspectives, other frames of reference, angles of vision, whatever you want to call it. That's what we're going to do in this episode today in my conversation with Richard Jacobson. I just want to take a second and mention before the interview with Richard that I'll talk a little bit more after about how you can get a hold of me on social media. And I'm also going to give you some information about how you can support the work of Mind Shift and the Preacher's Forum blog. And I want to talk to you about one of the new rewards I've just added to the closed Mind Shift podcast group on Facebook, which is what you get to be involved in by being a patron or a supporter of Mind Shift. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that after the interview with Richard Jacobson. So let's not waste any time. Let's get right into it. And let's see if Richard can live up to his claim that there is indeed such a thing as Christianity without all that churchianity. I'm so happy to be here with Richard Jacobson. You want to say hi to everybody, Richard?
Hello, everybody.
Yes. Thank you for being a part of the Mind Shift podcast. You're coming to us from, is it Nashville?
Yes, Nashville, Tennessee.
Nashville, home of the country music capital of the world.
Yeah, we've got country music, and the healthcare business is pretty big out here, and so is the printing industry because of all the Bibles that used to be printed here back in the day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've never been to Nashville. I've been to Memphis, but I never quite made it back that far. So one of these days, I'm going to get back to Nashville. Is it Nashville or Nashville?
You know, there's probably some debate. I do say Nashville, so, but then again, I'm also technically from up north. I've lived in Nashville most of my life, but technically I'm a Yankee.
You're a Yankee. You're in the wrong place then. Well, I'm so glad that you've agreed to be on this podcast. You've written a book called Unchurching, Christianity Without Churchianity. Can you explain to us what you mean by that term, churchianity?
Yes. Churchianity is the, really it's speaking to the common form of church that most everyone is familiar with today. And that is a church that has a building that, you know, at least here in the West is incorporated, or at least in America is incorporated as a 501c3 not-for-profit corporation. It has a constitution and bylaws. It has policy and procedure. It has titles and positions and hierarchy and programs. It is an institutional animal. And the book is a deconstruction of that institutional church model and an attempt to separate it from biblical church community, because obviously we don't see any of those things in the Bible, which means you can have institutional church, and I'm using air quotes, which you can't see. You can have institutional quote-unquote church without having genuine church community, but you can also have genuine church community without borrowing anything from the institutional church model. And I think one of the reasons it's important for this generation to separate those things is because right now we're seeing this major exodus from the institutional church. You know, millennials especially, there's all this talk about the duns, the believers who are done with church, but they're not done with Jesus. So they're walking away from the institutional church, but they're taking their faith with them. And so now the church is reaching this identity crisis where it's having to figure out, well, how much of this stuff is negotiable, because, you know, most of the institutional trappings are not appealing to the younger generation that wants genuine spiritual community without all of that corporate structure.
Yeah, so you mentioned that that's a big trend, isn't it? Especially millennials are leaving the churches in droves. So what is wrong with the institutional church, as you described it, that so many people are leaving it? What's it missing? What's it doing wrong that is not connecting with, especially that generation coming up, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's probably a whole other conversation in and of itself. And even though we're talking about my book, I would actually point you to another book, because I think there's another author who could speak to that with more authority. And that is Josh Packard's book called Church Refugees. And the reason I think that's a good resource for people is that he just went and asked that question of everybody who was leaving. So he actually did this big survey where he said, you know, well, what are the reasons you're leaving? And, you know, a lot of them had to do with changing values. A lot of it had to do with churches that tend to, and I want to say this in a way that doesn't sound disparaging, but a lot of what we do in church is for ourselves. And a lot of what you see in scripture is this mandate to have an impact on the world around us, you know, to have an impact on poverty and to especially minister to those who are marginalized and disenfranchised. And that very often doesn't seem to be the priority. And I don't know that it can be the priority when you have all this ministry overhead that has to be paid first.
Yeah. So is that the major priority? Keeping the plate spinning, keeping the lights on, the heating on, paying staff salaries. And all, by the time you've done all that, there's hardly any money left to actually go out into the community and do some good for the community or the world.
Yeah. And that's not, you know, we're getting, I don't want to say out of my depth, but that's not really the main focus of the book. However, I do touch on that And one of the things that I found interesting when I was writing the book is I looked at some statistics between what the average institutional church spends on itself versus quote unquote ministry, like actually the portion of the budget that goes to helping people versus what you see in the nonprofit world. And it's almost a mirror image. In the institutional church world, we're spending, you know, maybe 85-90% of the money that comes into the church on the church infrastructure, on buildings and salaries and equipment and programs and supplies and everything that goes into putting on these, you know, big productions. And 15% of it would go toward things that most people would consider the real ministry, like helping the poor. And then when you look at many nonprofits, it's the exact opposite. They might spend 10 or 15%, or at least the really good nonprofits that run really lean. They would spend maybe 10 or 15% on their infrastructure and supplies, et cetera. And the vast majority of the money that comes through goes to help people.
Yeah, and I think it reminds me of what you're talking about. Some of the things that Frank Viola in his book, Reimagining Church, he touches on some of these things, doesn't he? He talks about auditorium churches or entertainment churches where it's a major production, it's a professional production. So much money has gone into the lights and the sound and the musicianship and the sermon and the facilities itself that by the time that's all that money is spent, there's hardly anything left over to actually, well, in the words of theologically, you could say to be missional. That's kind of the key word here, isn't it? It seems like if millennials are saying we're not being missional as a church by meaning going out into the community, going out into the world, we're spending all of our money on the facilities and salaries and production. What are we doing here? Is that in your opinion, is that one of the major reasons why millennials are leaving the church?
Yeah, I mean, probably. Again, this is not really my area of expertise. My book is more of a theological deconstruction of the church model, not really a survey of why people are doing this or that. That's why I for that part of the conversation, I would defer to Josh Packard because he's put a lot of research into that and a lot of time into that. I don't feel that I can speak for the millennials. I can speak to them through the things that I have to say in my book, but I would not be the mouthpiece for them.
So what's kind of the thesis argument of your book? What would you say is the summary of your argument?
Basically, I was trying to fill a space where I saw there was a need in this conversation. Like, you know, again, if you want a sociological perspective of what's happening, read Josh Packard's Church Refugees. If you want a historical perspective on how we got to where we are, how these various things crept into the church from the culture around us over the past 1700 years, then you should read Frank Viola's Pagan Christianity, especially the edition that was co-authored with George Barna, because it's very well footnoted. It's very detailed. But what I saw, at least out of the books that I could find, what I saw that was kind of missing for me was, you know, people could tell me, here's how we got to where we were. And other people could tell me, and here's why others aren't connecting with it. And here's why they're leaving. But what I wanted to see was somebody deconstruct that institutional church model and point by point contrast it with scripture to not only show that it's extra biblical, but that it's anti-biblical. Because if you don't do that, then what ends up happening is people say, yeah, I see how all these things got into the church, but so what? You know, we have a lot of freedom in Christ, and it's really just a cultural thing, and it's not doing any harm. And I wanted to show, no, it actually does hinder the church from being what she is supposed to be.
Right. So in your understanding of it, then what is the church supposed to be about? What's the purpose of the church? Because as you say, a lot of people have left it for a wide variety of reasons. So it's not doing something right. In your view, what is that purpose?
Obviously, the church is multifaceted. And so you could speak about different aspects because, you know, the church is described different ways. The church is described as a body, and the church is described as a bride, and the church is described as a house. And I would say that each one of those highlights a certain aspect. For me, the standout one is the description of the church as a body, and specifically, you know, we use the language, but I don't know how much we mean it. While Jesus was here on earth in the flesh, he was confined to this very limited body. He had the body of a man, and that meant he could only go a certain distance in a day. You know, he could only touch and talk to so many people at a time, and it wasn't enough. And so his intention was to give that up, to fall to the ground and die like a seed, and to be multiplied. And so now his life has been multiplied throughout the church. And this is not just poetic language. What I am saying is the church is supposed to be a community of saints that are living by the life of Christ. The ministry that he started 2,000 years ago, that ministry, the ministry of Jesus, has not stopped. And I think very often we only conceptualize it in terms of him modeling it for us and then passing the baton to us. And definitely, on one level, that's true. But we really don't own the fact that he is still doing the work that he started. And he is still alive and active through his body, the church. And that's kind of a long answer to a short question, but that's something I don't know that we have a firm grasp on that anymore.
Yeah, something's been fundamentally lost in that process, because I think a lot of the people I talk to, most of my friends are not Christians. The people I work with are not Christians, but we get into a lot of discussions about religion and spirituality and things. And the one thing that I hear consistently from people, my friends, about the church and their perception of it is that they think that something, the church today has fundamentally lost sight of the sort of simple message of Jesus, if you will, that whatever it has become has almost no bearing with what, how he lived and how he treated people and those kind of things you were describing. Do you find that's the case in the States as well, that people have that kind of gut level reaction to their perception of the church from the outside?
Yeah, and not just losing sight of the message, but actually not being stewards of the presence of Christ. And an unbeliever looking at the church wouldn't describe it this way. I'm obviously speaking from the perspective of a believer. Because an unbeliever wouldn't even know to criticize the church based on this.
You think that's somehow not being manifested in most churches today?
I don't know that I could speak to that.
Yeah, that's a big statement. It's a big claim for sure.
Maybe an overstatement. And I definitely don't want to make an unfounded claim. What I do know is that you don't have to have the presence of God in an institutional church model. Everything is so well thought out and well orchestrated that the church service and the church programs can run just fine with or without God. And I think that's a disturbing thing about the institutional church model, is even though a lot of people are doing it very sincerely and their priority is for God to be there, the model that we're employing isn't dependent upon him showing up.
You can attend church planting courses and conferences. They'll teach you how to do all those things, won't they? I mean, I used to teach a course on church planting, and that was one of the things we covered in the module, was you can take all the elements and pieces of a quote-unquote successful model that's worked in other places and just replicate it somewhere else. And there's a good chance that it will succeed in terms of adding numbers and having a budget and staff and everything else. And there's certainly been a model that many, many church planters have used, haven't they, all over the world, just replicate an existing model.
Yeah, I mean, anyone that's ever been in a church that's gone through a building program campaign, a capital campaign for a building fund, is probably, if they were close enough to see the inner workings of it, then they probably know exactly how much we borrow from corporate America and that whole type of thinking and strategy. You know, literally these church consultants who help churches structure their campaigns can come in and say, oh, well, in a church your size, the demographics are going to break down this way. And then when we start launching the campaign, you're going to lose this many people because they're not going to like the campaign. And then it's going to take a year. And then in a year from now, you're going to have this many more. I mean, they've crunched the numbers and analyzed the data so much, they can tell you with a very, very high degree of accuracy, here's how this thing is going to play out. I mean, obviously, they're doing these things with the intent of reaching more people and sharing the gospel. I don't want to make it sound like the hearts aren't right, but I'm just saying it runs with a corporate business strategy where you could just literally take God out of the equation and it would still play out exactly the same.
It's like starting a business then, in effect, isn't it? A lot of the same principles apply. The markers that you just laid out would apply for starting a brand new business in a community, wouldn't they? You do your demographic research. You'd wonder, is this a product that I can sell in this area, whether it's a restaurant, cafe, a business, whatever it might be. You'd do a lot of the same things, wouldn't you? And it may or may not succeed.
Yeah, the funny thing is I've actually spent the past few years in and out of the startup world because I helped launch a music tech startup, and then since then I've consulted with other startups. What's funny is, it's absolutely the same. A lot of what I saw as an institutional church pastor has actually transferred over. Matter of fact, probably a lot of the skills that I'm using when I do consultations were honed in the institutional church. You know, they were just spiritualized. And, you know, now that I'm out in the business world, I kind of see, oh, well, these are actually skills that the church borrowed from the business world. It's maybe even a better fit out here than it was in there.
Yeah, that's got to be the ultimate irony.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Now, you mentioned a little bit ago, you said something about the model that you see in a lot of institutional churches is unbiblical. This is something that Frank Viola talks about in his book as well, that the problem with institutional church or auditorium churches is that it keeps people in a state of spiritual infancy because they're not allowed to exercise their gifts and their passions and things like that, because a small group of people at the top does everything, basically. They get all the important jobs. Does your book kind of touch on sort of that dynamic of leadership or the clique at the top that sort of runs everything?
Yes. And I, you know, not only do I touch on it in the book, but I have a YouTube channel that has some animated explainer videos. And one of my favorite videos that I created actually touches on this. When we think, okay, well, how does my pastor equip me? Well, the main thing that he does is he preaches a sermon every week. I mean, yes, he might do hospital visits and he might do marriage counseling and he might perform, you know, weddings and he might speak at funerals and any number of things. But the one thing that he does that touches everybody in the church is the Sunday morning sermon. Everybody sits and listens to him preach this sermon. And so if that's the main thing that he does that ministers to everybody else, then obviously that must be the way that he is trying to fulfill that passage that talks about equipping the saints. And if you look at the way that plays out, it's usually interpreted this way. You know, well, my pastor gave this great sermon series on having healthy conflict, or, you know, how to have better communication in your marriage, or, you know, how to raise your kids in the faith. And because of the things that I learned during that sermon, I feel more quote unquote equipped. That basically the way that we're understanding a pastor equips the church is by coming up with sermons that he thinks will enrich their life and then, you know, teaching them like a professor lecturing at a college. Well, okay, that's one way. The other interpretation, and it's almost the exact opposite interpretation, is what if God gave apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers to teach their particular specialties to the church so that the church could then do those things? And so, you know, as you work your way through the fivefold ministry, you start to realize, oh my gosh, you know, we're all supposed to teach, we're all supposed to prophesy, we're all supposed to, you know, be a witness. So you work your way through and it's like, oh my gosh, maybe equipping the saint is actually teaching them to do that thing that I have a special gift to do. And it makes sense when you think about it. You know, we learn math from a math teacher. We may not all become fellow math professors. We may not become a specialist where we become a quote unquote apostle, prophet, evangelist, pastor, or teacher, but we will learn to operate in all of those various gifts if the perspective is that they're supposed to be teaching us their specialties rather than using their specialties only to minister to us, you know, while we just sit passively and receive from them. Does that make sense?
It definitely does, because one of my favorite authors is Fred B. Craddock. He wrote a book, As One Without Authority, a great book on the sort of communication dynamic that goes on in sermons in most churches. And he says most sermons turn listeners just into passive recipients. And this is the problem with the whole model, is that all they have to do is the sort of go and do portion of the sermon. They just sit and listen to it. He does all the work, and you don't have to do anything except just take it in. And this is what I hear you talking about, with the problem with that model, isn't it? That's why listeners are kept in a state of infancy, because they don't have to do anything. They just put their money in the plate and show up every week and listen to the sermon and go home, I guess.
Yeah.
Here's a question. When you get into this issue of using scripture as your source for your theological argument, one of the things I recently posted on your Unchurching group was a classification, as I've been kind of working through different categories of people who have left the institutional church, because it's not just one type of person that's left the church. There's a lot of nuancing, isn't there? But one of the categories is people who have left the church for a variety of reasons. They still accept the scripture. They still accept Christ. They still believe in God. That seems to me like that's kind of the main category of person that you're targeting. Because what if someone doesn't accept the Bible anymore and says, well, Richard, you know, you can quote all these verses and you can say all these theological things, but I don't accept any of it from a biblical perspective. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And, you know, I'm not trying to be all things to all men. The book is specifically targeting what are commonly called the duns. And you know, and I don't know, maybe there are even subgroups within that. But when I say that, what I'm specifically thinking of are people who are done with the institutional church model, but haven't wavered in their faith as far as following Christ, wanting to be a disciple, even wanting to have a Christian community. You know, they just don't want the institutional trappings that go with our current form of church.
That's a big consideration, isn't it? Because if you've left the church, you still have, but you haven't given up on God, as it were, or maybe given up on people as well, then where do you go from here? It sounds like you're arguing for sort of the formation of Christian community. So if we can get that right, are you not so much concerned about the leadership aspect of it? Because there must be a place for leadership in general, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a place for leadership, but I mean, some of the baggage that we bring with us from the institutional church culture is an overemphasis on leadership. And let's face it, one of the reasons that we really celebrate and elevate leadership is because we want our pastors and other church leaders to basically live our spiritual life for us. You know, we want them to serve as a proxy for us. And maybe we're not aware that we're doing that, but it certainly shows in the things that we tend to value, you know, in the institutional church. And so, you know, when we wake up to the fact that, okay, this model isn't scriptural, it doesn't mean that we suddenly become deinstitutionalized. It doesn't mean that all of our habits and bad thinking just instantly fall off. It's a process. It's a deconstruction process. And so I don't think it's a good idea to necessarily start with leadership. Very often when you see people who say, okay, well, I'm going to leave the institutional church and I'm going to quote unquote start a house church or something like that, the first thing they do is go, okay, well, who's going to lead it? Or what does the leadership look like? And honestly, that is putting the cart before the horse, because the first thing you have to do before you even start to think about church community, the first thing you have to do is kind of rediscover community, because in American culture, and probably a lot of, you know, just all Western culture. Community is largely a thing of the past. You know, we don't really understand what it is to live in community with other people. You know, right now, some experts are declaring loneliness as the number one health epidemic in America, because they have determined, and this is quantifiable, measurable, indisputable, that people that they can identify as lonely, they don't live as long as people who aren't lonely, and they have a rash of other health problems. Loneliness actually has a physical effect. And now what's interesting about that is the staggering statistics on loneliness, like how many people you could actually categorize as being lonely, when we are more technologically interconnected than ever before. And so the phrase that I'm hearing more and more to describe the American experience is that everybody is alone in a crowd. So I say all that to say, I think it's premature to start saying we're going to learn how to be a church community when we don't even have the foundation of community yet. So the first thing we need to do is start relearning what it means to have a day-to-day shared life with other people. And then over time, absolutely, we want to start learning how to function as a church community. And then over time, maybe we want to look at and mutually deferring to each other. We might want to recognize those that seem to have a better grasp or seem to be pulling ahead and recognize those as leaders. But I think it's the exact opposite progression of how we plan an institutional church. Institutional church starts with selecting a leader, picking out some people who are going to be the church, and then eventually we're going to make disciples. And so this overemphasis on leadership and the way we idolize leadership and the way we tell ourselves this whole thing is going to crumble if we don't pick the right leaders, and this whole myth about spiritual covering, which is total nonsense. You know, well, we need to be under the covering of a pastor.
Just, it's sort of a default setting, isn't it? Like you say, it's part of that American culture. We see it over here in the United Kingdom as well, this sort of mentality that just says, oh, if we're going to start a church, we have to have a building, we have to send out invitations, we have to invite people, we have to go down and have our leadership team firmly in place before we do anything as far as numerically looking to grow. And so you just sort of plug in these sort of, I don't know, you say corporate model factors into this thing, and before you know it, you've got yourself a church. And you might even have 50, 60, 100 people within a few months. Those are the metrics for success in a lot of places, aren't they? Your church is numerically growing, so you must be doing everything right.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, because again, we borrow from the corporate business model, and the way that you judge success in corporate America is growth. And it's kind of scary that we've adopted those metrics, that we look at buildings. The joke is we look at the three B's: buildings, budgets, and butts in the seats, meaning, you know, how big is your facility? How much money do you have? And, you know, how is your attendance growing? And yeah, in terms of growing a church wide, maybe those are the metrics. But in terms of growing the church in any way that's deep, those aren't the metrics. Yeah. And that's a lot harder to plug into an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah,
so
there's no,
you know,
category.
We go for the things that we can see and the things that we can count
and measure. Yeah, numerically, financially, whatever. Well, now one of the questions I've been thinking about as you're describing this model, does church history teach us anything? Because what comes to my mind is the example of the Pietists in the 17th and 18th centuries in Germany, where they broke away from the sort of Orthodox Lutheran church. They were fed up with a lot of the cold, dead orthodoxy. And what strikes me when I read one of my favorite books is Philip Jacob Spener, Pia Desideria, and the critiques that he offers of the Lutheran church in the 18th century, they sound exactly like what people like you and others are saying of the church today. And then when the Pietists did break away, they formed house churches, they had a wonderful community, they were amazing, they started orphanages, the modern missions movement, but within a generation, they became insular, they became dysfunctional and sort of ingrown, and the movement kind of died out within maybe 100 years, and it became sort of this dysfunctional thing. What started out so great ended up, you know, becoming ingrown. I mean, do you see that as a possibility happening with sort of your model of, it sounds a lot like the Pietists, what they did.
Yeah. And I don't know that, I don't know that I would say there's a model proposed in my book. You know, I'm definitely right. deconstructing the institutional church model. So I'm deconstructing a model, but I don't know that I'm turning around and saying, therefore replace it with this. So I don't know that it's a model. However, yeah, I mean, as you look through all throughout church history, I mean, you know, for goodness sakes, we've had all these various revivals and movements, and, you know, very often, you know, a revival starts with the younger generation kind of casting off a lot of man-made tradition and limitations from previous generations. I mean, honestly, this was my childhood. You know, I'm a child of the Jesus movement. So this is how my church experience started, was in the midst of one of those type of revivals. And so that left an indelible mark on me in terms of, if not what a church should be, at least what a church could be.
Yeah.
And then, you know, people want to sustain it and, you know, keep it going. And so they put their hands on it and they start adding things to it. And I don't want to name names, but in my lifetime, I've seen a couple of famous revivals where all these incredible stories are coming out. And then all these other people from other parts of the country start to rush in. And then the people are going, okay, well, how do we organize stuff? And pretty soon they're figuring out little assembly lines, how to get people through, and, you know, how to handle the crowd. And, you know, it almost, it's like a pendulum. It keeps swinging back and forth. Like when the pendulum swings back in what might be the wrong direction, I don't know that it ever swings as far. I don't know, but I have to believe that the church is ultimately on a progression. And in my mind, that means we're not going to have any of this extra man-made, extra biblical stuff. It's just going to be the church the way Jesus envisioned it.
Yeah, this is a difficult question, because I remember you talked about that in one of your early podcasts. You guys mentioned that God's vision for the church, and I picked up on that phrase because I thought something that Hector Avalos, who's an atheist, he did a podcast with me a couple of months ago, and he said a lot of what passes for God talk, he says, is ultimately self-referential. I want God to be this way or that way because that's what I want him to be. Someone could accuse you saying, well, Richard, you have this idea that God has a vision for the church, but couldn't that be just a self-referential statement? You're saying that's what I want God to want the church to be. You know, how do you know that's actually God's vision? And what is that vision? What would you say?
Well, I don't know that I claim to have like the vision for what the church is supposed to be. I try to the best of my ability not to get out of my depth and not to speak to things above my pay grade. And that's why earlier when you were asking questions that, you know, were more about, you know, like, why are the millennials doing this or why are they doing that? I'm not the person to answer that.
Right.
I'm also not the person to answer, tell me what God's vision for the church is. If we're talking like in total, you know, like give me a synopsis of God's vision and heart for the church. I can tell you what I've seen so far, and I can tell you the things that really stand out to me in scripture, but I also know that I see in part. What I do know that I can do very well, and what the focus of the book is explaining why the thing we have is not the thing he wants. That I feel confident doing.
Right. So what does he want? That's the question then, isn't it?
To the degree that I understand that, I do speak to those things in the book. But ultimately, the focus of the book is deconstructing the institutional church model. That's largely what the book is for. If you're going to build and you pick a piece of property and there's a huge boulder in the middle of the field, you can't get any building done until you blow up that boulder. So a lot of my calling and passion is to remove the obstacles, not to necessarily come in and tell everybody how they should be doing everything, but saying, hey, you can't do anything until this thing is removed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so you're kind of leaving it up to the reader to go away and figure out what he or she needs to do on the basis of that sort of deconstruction. Is that what you're saying? Without just offering a whole series of, okay, here's what you should do, 1, 2, 3, 4.
I stay completely away from any sort of how-to. I avoid getting into, you know, because I get a lot of very specific questions from people saying, okay, well, I want to start a house church, and we're debating whether or not children should be part of our gatherings or whether they need to be somewhere separate, and, you know, just all this stuff. And people want me to answer that for them, and I very intentionally do not.
And maybe that's where Spener got it wrong, I don't know, in his book, because the first half of the book, he does a lot of what you're doing. He deconstructs the traditional church, but then the second half, it becomes a real how-to kind of manual, and I think maybe that's where he has some great ideas for sure. But then anything can become institutionalized, can it? Even a wonderful movement like the Pietists, or like you say, the Jesus People movement of the 60s coming out of the hippie generation and all that, it can become institutionalized, quantified, and the next thing you know, it's become the system that's become the problem. And then you've got to go deconstruct it yet again. Like you say, that pendulum swings from extreme to extreme, it seems like, doesn't it? Certainly in the history of the church, it has.
Yeah, and at the very least, I'm almost contradicting everything that I said in the beginning of the book if the main point that I'm making is that we need to reinstall Christ as the head of his body and let him lead his church. And, oh, by the way, I've been talking with him, and let me tell you what he's going to tell you. How in any way is that consistent if the main point of this is we need to quit installing a man in place of Christ?
Yeah, it seemed like ultimately that's a good definition of a life of faith, isn't it? Is you've got to go away and figure this thing out. There's not a manual. I mean, a lot of people think that the Bible is the rule book or the manual for life, and it's got all the answers in it. It actually doesn't have a lot of answers. There's a lot more questions, I think, than answers. You've got to go away and think about this stuff and work it out in your own context. Otherwise, all I'm doing is just following the rules that somebody else has laid down for me. And then I don't have any ownership of it. You know, that's one of the reasons why I think we walked away from the institutional church, is that I didn't have any ownership of what I was being told from the front. I'm sitting there going, I'm sorry, I just don't buy this anymore. I can't do this. I can't just sit here and give money to this thing. I don't believe this anymore, what you're doing. I know what you're doing because I used to be the guy up in front doing those things and saying those same things, but I can't do that anymore in good conscience. I think that was kind of one of the starts of our deconstruction away from the institutional church. Now, I'm curious, we probably should wrap it up a little bit toward the end, but what kind of responses have you got? I'm kind of thinking maybe one last question, because I know you've got an unchurching group on Facebook, and there must be, well, nearly, what, 4,000, over 4,500 members in there, something like that.
It's well over 4,000. It's quickly approaching 4,500.
Yeah.
And at the rate that it's been growing lately, I won't be surprised if it hits 5,000 pretty soon. I don't know what's happened, but we've suddenly had just a wave of requests lately.
Yeah, I saw a post the other day saying the administrators are struggling to process all of the people trying to get into the group. You're overwhelmed with requests from people to get in. I'm wondering, you know, what kind of response are you getting from people who have read your book, interacted with your podcast? Do you find a lot of people saying, yes, I'm finally finding a group of people here that are saying a lot of the same things, thinking the same things I'm thinking? What's the sort of responses that you get?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. And you know, you never know, is it that you got the message so right that most people who hear it respond favorably to it, or are you just getting the message out to the right people so that overwhelming response that's coming back to you is just, you know, it's positive because you're speaking to the right audience. And I don't know a way to separate those things. What I do know, like right now on Amazon, the book has 104 reviews. It's got a 4.6 average rating. The vast majority of the reviews on Amazon are 5-star reviews. Same thing with the podcast. So the feedback that I get is overwhelmingly positive. And you know, I've been doing this for a year now. You know, the book came out over a year ago. I've had enough people reach out to me directly and write reviews that I definitely, there's definitely a recurring theme. And so one of the things that people say to me all the time is, thank you for finally giving me the language to explain what I already felt, or thank you for helping me articulate something that I've always struggled with and never known why. And I mean, it's like, there's all these different ways of basically saying the same frustrations you were having, I was having, I just didn't know how to express it. So that's really the biggie for me. And I think, honestly, I think it's one of the best compliments I could have, because I feel like if I'm giving people the language to identify it, it can affect everything. It can affect their conversations with other believers who are similarly frustrated. And so they can now start to form community around, you know, some of these similar ideas because they have the language for it. It also gives them the language to talk to all their friends and family who say, hey, why did you quit going to church? And, it's so hard to try to explain to your family, I'm not falling away from the faith. I'm actually leaving the institutional church because I'm actually trying to get closer to Jesus. And that sounds insane to people with an institutional church mindset. It's like, well, if you're trying to get close to Jesus, you need to go to church. So being able to equip people to have that conversation has been a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I've had that experience too, and it's hugely empowering. I remember going to hear, I went to a conference up in Sheffield in England a couple of years ago, and I heard Father Richard Rohr talking about the kind of two halves of life spirituality model. And when he explained that, it just hit me like a ton of bricks, exactly what you just said. He gave me the language to describe what I was already going through, what I was already experiencing. And I came home, I was just blown away. I was telling my wife, you got to hear this guy. This is amazing. I played her the video because
yeah.
You go, I'm not alone in this thing. I'm not crazy. There's a lot of other people out there who are on a pretty similar path. That's hugely empowering and hugely, it's exciting, I think, to be in touch with people like yourself and just people in other groups as well that I'm a part of on Facebook. So, you know, thanks for putting the book out. Thank you for putting the group on Facebook. It's been great to connect with people, especially that we're, as I said to you in a message the other day, we feel kind of isolated over here in the UK because we're kind of out of that American evangelical scene. And so in a way that's good, but in another way, we don't have that kind of community. So we're trying to put things together over here in the UK. So hopefully we're going to put a meeting together sometime next year in Birmingham, which is kind of about in the middle of England. So hopefully that'll, you know, we can have some gathering with that community that you're talking about. Who knows?
Yeah, that would be awesome.
So thank you so much, Richard. Man. And it's been great to chat with you.
Thank you so much.
Well, were you convinced that there is indeed such a thing as Christianity without churchianity? Can you leave church? Can you be one of those duns that Richard was talking about and yet find that sense of community we were speaking of right there at the end? Now, I don't know what you identify with or where you see yourself on the spiritual spectrum, as it were, but perhaps you learned something, or at least were exposed to a completely different point of view or angle of vision by listening into the conversation with Richard. And as I said at the beginning, whether or not you agree with him or disagree, that cannot be a bad thing, to listen to someone else's point of view. And this is certainly something that Richard is passionate about. It's very clear from listening to what he has to say that he firmly believes in the concept of the church. One of the things that struck me when I listened back to the episode was that I myself, probably a year or more or so ago, I would have totally identified with where Richard is coming from now. And I said at the beginning of the podcast that I'd come back to this thing and try to discover where Richard lands on the spectrum. So if we go back to my article on Theology Corner, what happens after people leave the church? As I said, I identify at least 8 groups on this spectrum. People who've left church, and I'm sure there might be more, and this obviously has to be heavily nuanced, but I said I think Richard might be a number one, and a number one is a person who's left the church, okay, probably for a wide variety of reasons, that institutional church that Richard was talking about, but these people, they still identify as Christians, they still believe in God, they still believe in Jesus, they accept the scriptures as the authority, the word of God and all that. It's just that they want to keep doing church just in different ways, perhaps more organic, less hierarchical. And what you're going to hear from this group, and I think we did hear this a lot from Richard, kind of an argument that proceeds along this line. They believe that the current forms of institutional churches, in air quotes, are in many ways or scripturally doing church wrong. As Richard said, he believes it's unbiblical as far as he understands what church could be or should be based on a particular reading of scripture. And I think it's pretty fair to say that Richard definitely would fall in that number one category, because then when you go on to number two, you find here people who have left the church, like Richard, perhaps they still follow Jesus, they still believe in God, the Bible, and all the rest of it. It's just that this group doesn't want to participate in any form of intentional church gathering. They don't want to go back to church, whereas the number ones are still very much involved in this idea of, we want to do church, we believe in the concept of church, it's just we don't like the way it's being done now in what they call institutional churches. And I think what you're going to find is that the unchurching group that we were talking about, the Facebook group that Richard started, in my experience in the group, I think most of the people in the unchurching group are going to fall in that number one category. I think there may be a few number twos in there. Now, as I say, I was a number one, and then I shifted, though, to being a number two. I believed in the church. I was passionate about it. I used to argue about, you know, the Ephesians 4 thing that Richard was talking about, but I then shifted over to number two. I walked away from the church, and I said, no, I don't ever want to go back, but now I'm probably more in the five or six category. Now, if these numbers don't make any sense to you, that means you need to read the article and figure out what I'm talking about. But I would say, looking back on this thing, that the fact that Richard has so many people in that Facebook group, as he said, at the time we recorded this back in December, there was near about 4,500 people in the group, and it may be near to 5,000 now by the time this podcast comes out. So clearly, Richard and his book, they are reaching a huge number of people. There's a mass exodus of people who are leaving the church, but they still want to keep doing church. And these are the people, as Richard says, that he is targeting, that he's looking at in his book, in the unchurching group. So if this describes you, then you should definitely get involved in the unchurching group. You need to pick up Richard's book, see what he has to say, and you can interact with him on the group. And that's a good way to stay in touch with someone like Richard, as well as other people who are experiencing that. But, you know, just because you may identify as a number one now, you don't necessarily have to stay there forever. You're going to move perhaps along that spectrum and along that scale. And as I said before, this is the whole point. Someone like Richard might start you on that journey of deconstruction and discovery, and then you may find yourself moving along further down the spectrum or further off the charts. Who knows where you're going to end up, but you're not stuck in one place forever. That's the point. And even someone like Richard, he's here right now, but who knows where he's going to go in the next 6 months, year, who knows? This is all part of being on a journey. It's not about arriving and saying, I'm at a fixed point forever and things can never, ever, ever change. So this is food for thought. Now, what I'm interested in is hearing your feedback, thoughts, and comments. You can get a hold of me, as I said, a variety of different ways on social media. You can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can go to my Facebook page and like it at facebook.com/MindShiftPodcast. You can always send me an email and I'll respond to you. I do respond to people who do send me emails, preachersforum@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Instagram at MindShiftPodcast. And also I'd encourage you to drop by my website, preachersforum.com/blog. And there's a lot of great articles and resources on there, including some of the stuff that I wrote when I was a number one, just like Richard. So I've left that up there, that content up there, because it might be helpful to someone in terms of their own journey and their own walk and their own faith life exploration. Now, just a couple of things before we end this rather long episode. I did mention that there are some ways you can support this podcast. You can go to patreon.com/mindshiftpodcast, and there's a video there that talks about why I'm doing this show and what I'm all about. So what do you get for being a Patreon supporter for as little as $1 a month? Well, you get access to our closed, private Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. One of the things I've just recently done in the group is I just posted my article or my chapter of a book that's hopefully coming out within the next year or so. And it's my own personal story. It's 21 pages long. It's about how I was baptized 3 times when I was growing up in church. And it explains a lot of the stuff that went on in terms of the toxic theology, the toxic teaching in the fundamentalist and evangelical church that I grew up in. So if you want to read my chapter, then you need to become a supporter of the show and you'll have access to the group, and therefore you will be able to read my chapter on my experiences of baptism. Now, one last thing before I let you go, I want to say what's coming up next week. I've got part one of an interview with Seamus Clark, and the funny thing is that's not actually his real name. It's a pseudonym. And if you want to understand why he feels that he needs to have a pseudonym, you're going to have to listen in next week to part one of this absolutely fascinating interview with Seamus Clark. So be sure and tune in next Friday to catch that fascinating episode. Once again, thank you for joining me right here on Mindshift. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, on this journey of deconstruction and discovery. Yes,